listening to By the Well, a lectionary-based podcast for preachers recorded on the land of the Wurundjeri people.
Hello, welcome to By the Well. My name is Sean Winter.
And I'm Kylie Crabb.
And today we're looking at readings for the fifth Sunday in Lent. And we're going to be spending time looking at Ezekiel's vision of the Valley of Dry Bones in Ezekiel 37, 1 to 14. We'll look at Paul's instruction to the Romans in Romans 8, verses 6 to 11. And then we'll look at the story of Lazarus in the Gospel of John, chapter 11, and verses 1 to 45. Kylie, good to talk to you. I think this is the first time we've done a podcast together, so that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Let's start by talking about Ezekiel, which is probably quite a famous passage. People know this vision that Ezekiel has, but just give us a brief summary of what Ezekiel kind of sees in this valley.
Yeah, so people might be familiar with this vision that Ezekiel has. There are dry bones laid about in a valley that, you know, looks like a valley of death. And then gradually, as he is instructed to prophesy to these bones, and they start to kind of, I guess, come to life, we would think, but kind of built up together.
It's like
with
a zombie apocalypse.
Yeah,
happens. Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
Bones coming together, a bit of a, you know, the hip bone connects to the leg bone.
That's
kind
right,
of situation.
Yep.
Coming together and then, you know, building up a sense of, you know, what we might think of as a reasonable attempt at ancient anatomy with some sinew and some flesh and everything coming together. And then, of course, the spirit coming into these bones.
Yeah, so the bodies are kind of rebuilt and then the spirit comes in as the kind of final dramatic climax of the vision itself.
Yes.
It's interesting that the setting of the valley is quite an interesting one, because Ezekiel was in a valley right at the beginning of Ezekiel in chapter 3, I think. Yep. And there, the valley is the location where God basically declares judgment on Israel. Mm. Everything is going to go dreadfully wrong for them. They deserve everything that they get.
Yep.
And the valley, therefore, is quite clearly, given Ezekiel's dating and context, some kind of reference to exile understood as the consequence for Israel's idolatry and sinfulness and rejection of their God.
Yep.
So this is pretty important then, because this is in counterpoint to that.
Yes, and in like so much literature that is about the exile, we get this kind of what might seem to be a terrible, harrowing setup in that earlier material about finding the people of Israel responsible for their heartache and their difficulty, but it's in order to be able to flip things and give a sense of hope. So we're into the hope bit here,
I think. That's right. Isn't it interesting how that, all of that prophetic exilic literature works on both of those themes kind of side by side or intersperses between them, that exile is the cause for very explicit kind of self-reflection on what is wrong and why it's gone wrong and why we're in this mess that we're in, kind of good Lenten themes, I guess. But always with this counterpoint of the possibility of hope and restoration and God's saving deliverance of God's people, even in the midst of this dramatic and crisis situation.
Yes, exactly. That it is kind of there to, in fact, you see a trend through Second Temple Judaism to turn towards really putting the accent on the restoration side, which is a beautiful thing for us to reflect on, like you say, through Lent, including the difficulties and where everything's gone wrong and taking responsibility, but always with this accent towards hope.
Yeah, it's as if the hope only really can make sense or have its full effect once you take the other stuff, the bad stuff, seriously. Yeah. I'm quite struck in this passage by the fact that Ezekiel is kind of looks around and the first thing that happens is Ezekiel is asked a question. The question is whether... The question really asks the question, is hope even possible, given what you're seeing all around you, these kind of bleached out, dry bones, incapable of
any life?
Can they live?
Yeah.
And Ezekiel's response is, I think, interesting theologically, because he says, I don't know.
Really, that's over to you.
Yeah, that's right, exactly. Yeah. The only person who can answer that question, the only source of hope in this kind of context must be God. Yeah. So, you know, back over to you, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
And then gets the instruction to prophesy to the bones, and then the kind of, you know, the magic starts happening.
Yeah. The thing that connected to that, the thing that really strikes me about it is that it's such a kind of, it's such a communal vision, right? I mean, it's Ezekiel's vision, but it's the bones is a kind of, you know, graveyard of a whole community, and then it builds up to being the community restored. It's not a story about an individual or...
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. So I think probably in the history of interpretation, particularly Christian interpretation, this is a text that gets strongly associated with motifs of resurrection.
Yeah, and, yeah. It could be why it's on today's lectionary reading, right?
Maybe in anticipation of Easter.
Yeah.
Of course, resurrection is quite often understood as effectively some kind of conjuring trick with bones, to use the phrase of a once famous Bishop of Durham who got in a lot of trouble for using that phrase. But that's not what this is about. It's really not a resurrection narrative. It's a community restoration narrative. Yes. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, I think so. Yeah, that's right. And that because it goes in that exilic tradition, you know, we've got this promise of the people. And I mean, I've also heard, this is spoken about in very moving ways when we think about, you know, in terms of what would you preach on about this text?
Yep.
Looking around at the God's community now and thinking, you know, can these bones live?
Yeah.
Like where
are the signs of hope?
Yeah.
And what do we need to speak in order to create the possibility of hope?
Yeah.
Within our communities. Can we just talk briefly about the reference? I think it's towards the end, verse 14, where we get this very explicit, I will put my spirit within you and you will live.
Yep.
And this is language that relates back to earlier chapters in Ezekiel 33, 36, where we get this notion of God replacing the covenant, the old covenant, with a new covenant or a restored or renewed covenant, which is the gift of the spirit. I mean, we're going to pick up spirit language in the Romans reading as well. Yeah. In the ancient world, I mean, when that language was used, what were people thinking about? Yeah. Clearly, it's associated with the idea of wind or breath, which is part of the vision.
Yes.
But what else does the notion of spirit language conjure up within this kind of scene?
Yes. I mean, it's a great question as well, because we're so easily sucked into thinking in a kind of like Platonist way about dividing people up into bodies and souls or something like this, and to having a really sense... it's sort of assuming that this is a kind of immaterial thing.
Right.
And so this would be like, I think, an incorrect path to go down in thinking about this, but that to think of spirit as a real material thing in the air around you, but like something that is actually a part of bodies themselves,
I think. So we work on a kind of the relationship between the spirit or things that are spiritual or God's spirit.
Yes.
We often operate that in a kind of zero-sum game with stuff like bones and flesh and bodies and all those other things. Whereas in the ancient world, that's not what's happening at all. The spirit is seen as a kind of material thing that is, I mean, the scholars say, you know, infused into
into the body. Particles of stuff. Yeah.
The stars are kind of made out of the spirit in some kind of later Greek traditions. So, and that feels very consistent with what Ezekiel sees here, that the spirit comes and comes into the body and kind of as stuff that animates and gives life to the body becomes this vision for the restoration of a community and a society. And I think that's a pretty kind of powerful vision for how we think about what is actually, what is needed to transform society isn't a kind of spiritual withdrawing from it, but some kind of spiritual engagement with it.
Yes, absolutely. So it's not about you're either spiritual or you're material. This is actually a whole part of the, not just the individual human, but the whole community being made new.
That's great. That probably sets us up for the flesh-spirit dualism in Paul. We'll talk about that in just a second.
If you'd like to know more about By the Well or any of our hosts, please visit bythewell.com.au.
So, Sean, getting into Romans 8 then, what do you want to, first of all, right from the start, draw our attention to in this important passage?
Well, probably the first thing to say is by the time you get to Romans 8, you should be exhausted. And many people are, of course.
That's right. It's famously about where people stop, isn't it?
It is, pretty much. Let alone Romans 9 to 11 and the stuff that follows. So Romans 8, we are in the middle of this incredibly dense thicket of Pauline argumentation, primarily oriented towards, I think, this question of what does participation in the new life that Christ brings, what does that look like? Which is another way of Paul saying, what does salvation look like? How do you actually know that it's taking place? What are its contours and its dimensions? And for Paul, as the later chapters will tell us, that's not an individual thing. That's oriented towards how communities live in relationship with one another in a very significant way.
Yep.
So there are parallels back, I think, to the Ezekiel question.
Yeah.
Romans 8, though, is kind of building all of that argument to something of a climax, a kind of culmination, and by the end of Romans 8, of course, we get this extraordinary vision of the whole of creation being redeemed and the Spirit being given so that actually the community knows how to pray for that kind of cosmic transformation and renewal and restoration. But Paul sets it up with this contrast, this dualism between the flesh and the Spirit. And this is probably quite a common trope that we're familiar with. And again, I think very easily, Paul often thinks in dualistic terms. It's this or it's that. It's wrong or it's right. It's black or it's white.
Yeah.
It's flesh or it's spirit.
But then he'll tinker with it, right?
But then he'll tinker with it. And we fall into the dualism and replicate it, I think, often at our peril.
Yes.
So here the important thing to say is that while Paul does say very negative things about the flesh, actually I think in Paul's theology overall, the flesh in and of itself is not the problem. Life in the flesh is not in and of itself the problem. And that what he believes is that flesh and bodies are the site on which, you know, those powers in the world that are hostile to God, the power of sin, the reign of death, all the things he talks about in Romans 5 to 6, those things exercise their power on the site of the body and the flesh, which is really another way of saying they exercise their power in the location of human living.
Yes.
And human relationships, including all of the things that we do with our flesh, work and sleep and play and have sex and all the rest of it. So it's inevitable that we kind of could leave with the impression that Paul thinks that if we go for the Spirit, then we need to drop all of that stuff.
Yep.
But that's not quite what Paul says here. And the language that he uses is that, you know, you're either in the flesh or you're in the Spirit. Mm. And if you're in the flesh, that means pretty much you're not able to please God because you're captive to these other powers. But if you're in the Spirit, you will be liberated from that power. You don't escape the flesh, you don't leave the flesh, you don't leave the body. And as Paul says in verse 11, the reason that this is all possible is because of the resurrection of Jesus.
Yes. And so it's not actually even right that the he's also not saying even in this contrast that bodies are bad, right? Because in fact Romans 8 is going to lead us into this discussion about the longing of not just the redemption of our bodies but the whole creation as a kind of site of real existence.
Absolutely. Yeah. So if you look in verse 10, we get this phrase, if Christ is in you, though the body is dead because of sin, the Spirit is life.
Yep.
And you might think that means, oh gosh, we don't have a body now, we should have the Spirit.
Yeah.
But then in verse 11, the one who raised Christ from the dead will give life to your mortal bodies through his Spirit that dwells in you.
Yes.
So we've got a very similar vision here to the one in Ezekiel, I think.
Yes.
The Spirit understood as this very concrete, real part of what it means to be a human being that God places within us.
Yes.
A material reality in our lives. I mean, quite what we do with that in the modern world is a philosophical question that exegetes don't need to deal with. But Paul is very clearly saying the work of the Spirit is not beyond the bodies or beyond the flesh. It's in the transformation of and the orientation of the flesh towards the new life that Christ brings.
Yes, and exactly, and that it is couched in within this kind of eschatological vision too, that of course we know from earlier in Romans is already part of current experience, that what God has done in Christ has already changed things, but that this is a kind of promise that we live into at the same time.
Absolutely, we share and participate in this new reality, and we do so in a way that is oriented not just towards ourselves and our own salvation or resurrection, but towards that wider social, communal, and for Paul, eventually cosmic, by the end of Romans 8, transformation, renewal, and restoration. So I think those are good themes to kind of think about in Lent as we build up towards Easter, because what they do is they broaden out our sense of what the significance of Easter Sunday and the resurrection narratives themselves are about, because, of course, they're cast in the stories of encounters between individuals, but actually what's going on is the first taste of some new reality that is possible in the world and in human societies and communities.
Yes, yep.
However, we'll go back to individuals and let's talk about Lazarus in just a moment. So John chapter 11, Kylie, the raising of Lazarus, a story of Jesus and a family, brother and sisters, wonderful Johannine dramatic story, typically Johannine in length.
Yes,
And typically Johannine in some of the kind of ambiguities that are woven into the language here. But basically, just set John 11 in the wider context of the plot of John's gospel for us. Yes. Where does this come and what's its significance?
I mean, it's one of the things about John, right, that we get these really long episodic narratives. And in fact, I think across the lectionary, people will have just, this will be the third kind of 45-verse-ish kind of Johannine passage to deal with in a row. So I'm sure people are getting very creative about how they're presenting the reading within the service being able to engage with the whole narrative. But they are rich narratives that bring all their stuff to life, one would say. This is getting towards the end of what we often call the public ministry of Jesus in John's gospel. And things have been, in a way, escalating. We've had these kind of long interactions between Jesus and various individuals along the way. And this is the one that really tips things over the edge. By the end of this, we've got opponents of Jesus really plotting his death. And of course, we've had all of these kind of I am sayings that people, you know, where there's a kind of Christological claim from Jesus about who he is using some kind of imagery. Here we've got I am the resurrection and the life. And this is a kind of these are building up as well, I guess, across the story.
So it's the kind of last of the public, the Johannine signs, these signs that Jesus does through these first 11 chapters. The fact that it's about resurrection, the raising of someone, has this kind of strategic or climactic significance in the Gospel of John. It's the thing that then actually generates the hostility against Jesus that leads to the Jesus going to Jerusalem for the Passion.
That's right. And sort of shortly into the next chapter, in chapter 12, Jesus will have some Greek people come to him, and this will be the moment that he's like, okay, the hour has come. So there's this big shift. And then, of course, we know that there's still plenty more chapters of John to go, but there'll be, whatever it is, three or four chapters of the farewell discourse at the Last Supper and stuff. But, John's gospel, in a way, with these, it has these really long narratives, but it doesn't actually have that many episodes. We are getting to the kind of culmination there.
And we're on our way towards Easter very clearly.
Very clearly, yeah.
So Lazarus is ill?
Yes.
Is he ill? Is he unwell, sick?
Very good question. The Greek word that is asthenai here is a word that gets used for, it's literally kind of, if you can have a literal single meaning, but it's kind of weakness. But that is also the word that gets used for what we might think in a contemporary setting as being disability. It's a word for illness. He dies, so he's obviously extremely unwell in some kind of in some way, but there's also this interesting dynamic that's set up. Some disability readers will say, this is an interesting idea that maybe Lazarus has some kind of infirmity, that some kind of disability, and then his sisters are kind of jockeying around him, providing support. It's an interesting interaction because, of course, there's all this stuff between Mary and Martha and Jesus, but we don't ever hear Lazarus speak,
right?
Which is interesting, unlike last week when we're thinking about the blind man. John 9, where he does speak.
There's no dialogue between Jesus and Lazarus. No. All Lazarus has to do is kind of stumble out of the tomb.
Following the call where Jesus calls out, come out. out. Yeah. So there's a number of interesting things there. And, of course, we might be sort of morphing in our heads other examples of times when we've met Mary and Martha before, but in Luke's gospel, right, right. Where Jesus goes to their house. So there's some kind of friendship here going on.
Well, I mean, there's a stunning phrase in verse 4, I think, a saying of Jesus, when the sisters send the message, "Lord, the one that you love is ill, Asthene is unwell." And when Jesus heard it, he said, this illness does not lead to death. Yeah. Rather, it is for God's glory. Yeah. So it's not just, I'm going to cure the illness, but the illness itself is understood as something which points towards the glory of God that is about to be manifest in the act of Jesus raising Lazarus. It's a kind of really powerful way of thinking about how Jesus regards this situation and whatever it is that's happening to Lazarus.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, it could also, you might stumble over that bit because you might think, oh, what is this going, like Jesus is just like letting this thing happen so that there can be some kind of like sound and light show that can be very convincing, which of course is ironic because in John's gospel there's a lot of skepticism about people who believe on account of the signs only. But we do get this kind of sense here of a kind of, I don't know, like a double meaning of resurrection or being brought back to life.
Yeah, so the delay for 2 days longer
suggests
that then Lazarus is raised on the third day after hearing about it. So that's pretty interesting. And this thing that, which you've mentioned in chapter 12, that Jesus only does things in John's gospel when the time is right, and he gets to determine when the time is right. He's not a victim of other people's plans or circumstances.
Yeah.
Very much in control.
Yes. Which actually is really interesting, don't you think, about, you know, so we know this picture of John's Jesus as being kind of controlling things from the wings kind of thing, or from the center stage, in fact, moving things around. But then when we come to it, we get this very famous, very short verse that Jesus cries.
Yeah.
So he's having this emotional, affective response. He's not this. Sometimes people criticize Jesus as being kind of this passionless, perhaps stoic kind of figure, almost docetic, like all God, no human.
God striding upon the earth, as Kaiserman used to put it.
Yes, that's exactly right. But actually that's not, I mean, you can only get that picture if you like remove a whole lot of stuff that's actually part of the story. So Jesus cries here. He's very moved by something, the grief of his friends, the death of Lazarus, but he also knows that this is going to be undone, as it were.
I think that helps me to just, I mean, remind those who preach from these stories in John that even though we always know that these stories are hovering on all sorts of different levels of significance and meaning, symbolic and theological and, you know, mythic and all the rest of it, actually they are also human stories. And the task of the preacher is to kind of get inside the human stories using imagination and kind of what you can know about the ancient world and the context, like to get inside the humanity of this situation of illness, death, grief, hope, lack of hope, frustration with someone who doesn't turn up when they're supposed to, actually brings the text alive and gives people actually a chance to then engage directly with those deeper layers of meaning that are present.
Yes. Yes, because in fact he's dead, right?
Right.
So this is a part of what is important in this story is that, despite that kind of statement in verse 4 about it doesn't lead to death, I mean, he's dead. And I guess the other part of the double thing that we've got going on here is that Jesus calls him out, and then the text says the dead man walked out. So he's still described
as a
dead man with this adjective. So and then he says, "Unbind him and let him go." And I think that there is fantastic stuff to be wondered about in the context of a worship service and in preaching about this kind of double role for bringing Lazarus back to fullness of life, which is that, yes, it is sort of in the same way as maybe the Ezekiel thing about, you know, can these bones live? I don't know. Can you tell me? There is an element that is, of course, divine action that enables this dead man to walk out of the tomb. But the community response is also crucial. Like they have to remove the bindings that are around the corpse, and it's only then that he then lives.
So the grave clothes become symbolic for all sorts of, you know, metaphorical bondage, slavery, entrapment, you know, constriction.
Yep.
So the language of loosing those, it's one of the... When you learn Greek to begin with, you often use the verb luo, the verb to loose. This is one of the few places where
it's,
actually
in the
useful.
Text.
That's right. So loose him and let him go. You know, that's fantastic.
Exactly.
One of the great ironies is that when I used to do a lot of funeral services, sometimes you would walk ahead of the coffin into the chapel and you would read from John 11, I am the resurrection and the life. Yes. And the words that follow are, those who live and believe in me will never die. And you read these words with a body in a coffin behind you that is quite emphatically dead.
Yes.
So this is a raising story, but is it a resurrection story? What actually goes on in the thing that Jesus does to Lazarus, do you think?
Yes. Well, I mean, firstly, that is a beautiful reflection on thinking about human experience, right, in this story. There's all of our hymns and whatnot, you know, death has lost its sting, blah, blah, you know. Yep. I don't know if you've been in a worship service when someone you love deeply has recently died, but these can be, in some contexts, wonderful affirmations, and in some other contexts they can feel really hurtful because you're like, actually, I can really feel the sting. Yeah, I don't know what you're on. This is, you know, there is a real thing here. So to be able to affirm both of those things and to say that what your question is getting at there, that there is a difference here between what happens in John 11 and what is going to go on to happen in, you know, John 20 and whatnot. So the
raising of Lazarus and the resurrection of Jesus aren't quite on the same page, but one clearly is kind of foreshadowing or pointing towards the other.
Yes. So, I mean, Lazarus is restored to life in this way that is both the work of Jesus, who is the resurrection and the life,
right,
and the community working together. So, but Jesus's resurrection is actually going to kind of completely alter something. You know, this is in John, of course, it's the cross. The lifting up has changed something, but so has the incarnation. So the very fact that the Word is now, has become flesh and is dwelling among us in this story has already changed things, but in a way that is pointing towards this resurrection.
So that although resurrection is an Easter story, it's also a Lent reality.
Yes.
Because it's available here and now in the present, in those moments of grief and darkness and self-examination that we all experience and encounter, and that this text and the Ezekiel text in particular, I think, reflect upon.
Yes, and I think within that there is then an invitation to think about how we are participants in this. You know, in what ways are we bringing resurrection life to our communities, and in what ways do we allow the grave clothes to remain around people?
That's great. Thanks, Kylie.
Thanks,
been great
Sean.
Talking to you.
Yes, you too.
By the Well is brought to you by Pilgrim Theological College and the Uniting Church in Australia. It's produced by Adrian Jackson. Thanks for listening.